being, your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Morning. We're delighted to welcome with us for this oral argument Wisconsin Lutheran High School students. Would they please stand? Good to see you. You may be seated. And we also have students from Cashton High School. Would they stand? You're outnumbered, but you're strong. Please be seated. These students are here with us on a program, a national award-winning program, sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. The program involves the invitation to all the high schools in the state to join us for an oral argument. And if the invitation is accepted, the students are given copies of the brief on the case they're about to hear. And many schools do a variety of activities in regard to studying these briefs. And then the students come to an oral argument, and as part of the Court with Class program, they meet at lunch with a justice of this court. Everyone is invited to attend the session with the justice at the close of this oral argument. The discussion will involve the procedures of the court, not the substance of this particular case that you are to hear. And this noon, the students will meet with Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, who is to my left. And while I'm introducing justices, I will introduce the others. To Justice Bradley's left is Justice David Prosser. And to Justice Prosser's left is Justice Lewis Butler. I am Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. And to my right is Justice John Wilcox. And to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far right, Justice Patience Robinsack. Having made these introductions, we will now call the second case for today, 03-0384CR, State versus Dennis L.R., arguing on behalf of the intervener, Dawn R., is Dwight D. Darrow. We'll hear from Attorney Darrow.
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin. My name is Dwight Darrow, the law firm of Darrow, Dietrich, and Hawley of Sheboygan, Wisconsin. I do represent Dawn R. She is the intervener in the criminal case involving the State of Wisconsin versus Dennis L.R. I think a brief introduction as to who is who in this case is of some merit, and I'll do that quickly. We need to start with a young lady of about 5 years old now, and her initials are K.L.R. Her mother is Dawn R., her grandfather is Dennis L.R., and her great-grandmother is Helen. And those folks are important because they're all involved in this case. It is KLR's confidential relationship with her psychotherapist that is at issue in this case. KLR's grandfather, in May of 2002, a criminal complaint was issued alleging that he sexually assaulted KLR. And in this case, the KLR had gone to therapy with her mother and her sister on these and other related issues. And at one point in time, KLR's mother came home and shared some of the information that occurred during a psychotherapy session with Dawn's mother, or KLR, I'm sorry, Dawn's grandmother, or KLR's great-grandmother. And it is that sharing of information that it provided the basis for the trial court in this case to find that KLR's parent waived KLR's physician-patient privilege, and it is that finding that brings us here today. From a procedural standpoint, this case comes to us after the trial court ordered the production of KLR's mental health care counseling records, reviewed those records in camera, and then granted the state's request for an in-camera interview of KLR's treating psychotherapist only after finding that KLR's physician-patient privilege had been waived by KLR's mother. The trial court then granted a request made by KLR's mother to intervene in the criminal case for purposes of appealing the trial court's decision on the waiver issue. Against this brief factual backdrop, we are given the opportunity to clarify the issue of who may waive the physician-patient privilege established under Wisconsin Statutes 905.04, subs 2 and 3. In preparing for this date, it has become clear to me that the starting point in analyzing this question is this Court's recent holding in Sampson v. Gale. When we compare Wisconsin Statutes 905.03, the attorney-client privilege statute, with the Wisconsin statute section 905.04, the physician-patient statute, we find that we have nearly identical statutory provisions with respect to the identification of the privilege and with respect to who may claim the privilege. In Sampson, this Court held only the client can waive the attorney-client privilege under Wisconsin statutes 905.11 regarding attorney-client privilege documents. Court held, according to the text of 905.03 2 and 3 and 905.11, the client holds and controls the attorney-client privilege, and only the client can waive it. I believe that the similarity between Wisconsin statutes section 905.03 2 and 3 compared with the provisions of statutes 905.04 subs 2 and 3 mandate the same analytical starting point.
Mr. Dell, isn't that a problem when you're dealing with a young child? Are you suggesting that the only person that could waive the privilege in regard to records of this nature is a 3 or now you said 5-year-old child?
Records is a separate issue, and the law provides that under 146.81 and 51.30 that the disclosure of records can be made, and the statute specifically states, enumerates a number of people, a parent, a guardian, conservator, etc. So as to records, no, that's not what I'm suggesting. As to testimonial privilege under 905.04, I am suggesting, quite honestly, that this Court take on the job that it looked at in State versus Speezy, 199 was second, 597, where the Court said, we decline to resolve whether and under what circumstances a circuit court must appoint a guardian ad litem or counsel to assist the minor in making a decision regarding the physician-patient privilege.
Was your suggestion there that it would have to be a guardian ad litem who would waive that privilege?
Yes, that is. And that's based on well-established case law, both in divorce cases and in personal injury cases. We cited the Court to Jensen versus McPherson, a malpractice case involving a minor child, where the Court of Appeals sanctioned the reinstitution of that lawsuit because the minor child was not represented by a guardian ad litem. And in that case, the Court of Appeals went through a lengthy analysis as to when the statute says guardian, as it says in 905.04.3, as it uses the word guardian or conservator. In McPherson, the Court of Appeals said this definition makes clear that a guardian must be appointed by the court, whether a general guardian of the property or guardian ad litem. The definition also demonstrates that our legislature did not intend general guardian of the property to be equated with a minor's natural guardian.
Well, now here the trial judge talked about appointing a guardian ad litem. I'm not clear in my own mind. Did that happen?
No. The trial court, based on the record, took up the issue sua sponte, on its own, and addressed the issue whether or not a guardian ad litem should have been or should be appointed, and came to the conclusion that it could not say that the mother was not acting in the best interest of the child. That order was not appealed from. My client didn't enter this case until February of 2003, long after the time period for appealing that decision or taking that decision up on appeal had expired. But that's in the record. The court did look at this. We have a very able trial judge here in this case, and it recognized that concern probably under State versus Speezy. And there isn't enough guidance, I think, on the issue. We have guidance in personal injury cases. We have guidance in divorce cases. When issues regarding minor children arise in placement or custody cases, we're required to have a guardian ad litem appointed. There isn't the guidance in criminal cases because the minor child is not a party to the action. And it only makes sense that we kind of ignore that, if you will, or put that aside until the issue hits us square in the face, which it did in this case. The mother appeared. The mother wanted the child's relationship, confidential relationship with the therapist protected. The court took a look at that issue. And I don't know that the guidance is there for the judge to say anything, but the mom seems to be acting in the best interest of the child. So I'm not going to appoint a guardian ad litem. And I think that's an issue of guidance rather than correctness of interpretation or burden.
Didn't the excuse me for interrupting.
I'm sorry.
Didn't the your client, the mother, didn't she at the Court of Appeals level, she admitted, I guess one of the reasons, she admitted that she had the authority to waive the privilege.
Actually, no.
Now that's the state's argument.
That's the state's argument, but actually what's said in the brief, in the Court of Appeals brief, is that she had the authority to raise it, not to waive it. There's a difference, because in Sampson, the attorney is one of those enumerated parties under 905043 that can raise the privilege, one of those enumerated people. But this court has ruled that even though they may raise the privilege, they cannot waive it. That privilege resides, vests in the client and nobody else. So here in this case, and there's a lot of argument about this, but in this case, let's assume that the state is right, that we should look at Black's Law Dictionary and determine what guardian means when we look at 90504 sub 3 and say, well, gee, it says guardian or conservator, and guardian could be a biological parent. Let's assume that's true for a moment, because I don't think it matters when it comes down to the analysis because of what was done in Sampson. So even though the parent, if they're an enumerated party who can waive the privilege, that does not mean that they can raise the privilege. It does not mean that they can waive it. It's interesting to note there is no statutory section, other than 90511, enumerating anyone who can waive the privilege other than the privilege holder, and that is important in this case.
Counselor, I have a concern because your argument presumes there is a privilege under these circumstances. I'd like you to address for me section 90504, sub 4, sub E, 2. And it seems to say on its face that when there's an allegation that the therapist or caregiver believes shows the child has been assaulted and not by accident, that there is no privilege. Does that fit in this case at all?
It's a very important point, and I analogize that section to 90504C in personal injury cases where it says there's no privilege in a personal injury case either. We all know that's not true.
Well, she's not raising the issue here, so I think it's very different than what goes on in a personal injury case where you have a claimant against a defendant that says, you hurt me and this is how I was hurt. That's not what's going on here. Here we have the state prosecuting for the violation of a criminal statute.
But what I meant was, from a statutory reading perspective, there is a, on the face of it, a complete waiver of privilege under C as well. But let's take a look at 90504-4E2. Originally, that was raised back in 1963 as a result of an article in the Milwaukee Journal about a child that was mutilated, and there was some criticism of the doctor for not going to the authorities with that case. And the doctor said, wait a minute, there's a privilege here. So the state legislature responded in what was then 325.21 by saying that in those cases where a doctor has an opinion as to abuse, that opinion is not privileged. In fact, the original statute had as a following paragraph that compelled the doctor to take that opinion to the local DA or the local county sheriff. But let's ask ourselves the question, what if there is no privilege? We don't need SHFRA. We don't need Green. We don't need then any review in a criminal case as to whether or not a criminal defendant can have access to a minor child victim of sexual assault's medical records.
It depends on how broad the area is covered. In other words, I hadn't been reading the statute as you suggest, that if there's an allegation a physician believes indicates sexual assault, that everything in the child's medical records from birth to the moment at hand is fair game and open. I think it speaks to the sexual assault, doesn't it?
Well, the statute says there's no privilege in a situation where an examination or an abuse or neglect of a child creates a reasonable ground for opinion of the physician.
Right, but it's the examination of the abused and neglected child that is at issue that I understand to be where there is no privilege. And you're telling me, no, it doesn't apply here, but isn't that what we're asking this therapist, or is therapy different than an examination?
No, what I'm saying is I don't think that portion of the statute, 90504-4E2, can be read so broadly. When you look at the starting point where it says the opinion is not privileged, so that the opinion and the report can be made. And we have, since 1963, obviously, the mandatory reporting statutes that have come into effect. So what I'm suggesting is if we're going to read 90504-4E2 broadly, that there is no privilege when we're dealing with a person who has examined a child and believes there's abuse or neglect, that there is absolutely no privilege. Then I'm concerned that we've opened the floodgates to criminal defendants getting medical records of every victim who has been examined by a doctor. Then we're going to be arguing over whether that's an examination concerning abuse or neglect.
I want to focus back on just what the statute applies to. I mean, the district attorney can get the records all day under another section of the statute. In fact, that's how they were gotten under Chapter 146, correct? So the district attorney is going to have the records. Here we're not talking about the records because both sides have them. We're talking about an examination of a therapist. And I guess if the therapist had the opinion that the child had been assaulted, are you telling me that that's the only thing the therapist can say, yes, I have that opinion, and that by giving that opinion, that therapist would not be able to ask why you believe that? You think that why would be outside the scope of the statute? Because it
yes.
seems to me that's what we're dealing with.
That's exactly right. I think we have to respect the overriding privilege that belongs to, in this case, the minor child. Otherwise, we have abrogated the privilege. And I think once you begin that process, it's going to be hard to end it. In this case, you're exactly right. The medical records, well, they weren't actually disseminated. They were brought to the trial court under a Schiffer-type view, in-camera inspection. And then that was, we want to bring, now we want
but
to bring
the district attorney doesn't operate under Schiffer. The district attorney operates under Chapter 146. Schiffer is a defense counsel's motion based on totally different policies. The defense counsel can't get the records under Chapter 146. But the district attorney can, and it's my understanding from what I read in the record that that's how they got them.
No.
The district attorney was concerned with whether they could share them with Dennis's counsel. And that was brought under Schiffer.
No.
Yes, no.
No.
No. All right, you tell me.
What happened procedurally, as I understand it, is the district attorney asked the mother, Dawn, to sign an authorization, which she did to allow them to get the records. Before they got the records, she
recorded. Right.
Then the district attorney went to the court and said, we need to get these records, joined in by the criminal defendant, as I understand it. And the court said to the district attorney, try to get the records. And the district attorney's office came back and said, we can't get the records. And then the court, as I understand it, said, here, issue a subpoena for the records.
Right.
Then they were turned over to the court in camera, is my understanding.
Okay. Well, the district attorney has rights all day under 146.82, which I think is clearly in the record. It was in the Court of Appeals opinion also. But I don't want to really argue about that. I'm very concerned about the exception to privilege and your interpretation that the only thing the exception applies to is the doctor's opinion the child was sexually assaulted, but no one can ever ask him or her why.
Correct. I think once we, because if you take the opposite view and say under 90504-4E2, there is no privilege. So now we have a privilege holder, whether it's a therapist or a clergyman or someone else,
yep,
who has counseled with a minor child. And now we have an allegation in a criminal court of a sexual assault of that child. And now we're going to have no privilege. That means the criminal defendant, we don't need Schiffer. The criminal defendant can bring in that therapist and say, there's no privilege. What does that mean?
But, counselor, what the criminal defendant generally wants is not
why the doctor thinks the child was sexually assaulted. They want to know if this is a child that's had false reporting before, if this is a child that's done all sorts of other things before that may be in health care records that are 10 years back if you have a 12 or a 13-year-old child that's assaulted. So Schiffer goes way, way, way beyond what the statute is directed at, a specific opinion. It goes to the general health reliability of the witness as a reporter.
And my concern is abrogating the privilege under 90504-4E2 allows you to open the floodgates then. Because unless we're going to confine it to just the opinion, then what is to stop? What is left to stop the discovery of all health care information? And more importantly, as in this case, what's to stop the process from getting the mental sense and impressions of the therapist or the clergy member or the attorney, whoever happens to be the one in that privileged relationship? If, and I understand we're talking about the medical privilege because that's a specific
exception. It's got a very different exception.
Right. And so under any doctor or any psychologist, or I should say psychiatrist, or anyone along those lines, then there isn't any barrier to the discovery of that evidence because it's certainly relevant, it's certainly material. And then we have criminal defendants who have the floodgates open.
But Mr. Darrow, if I could follow up on Justice Rogenstein's question, because maybe I'm having the same difficulty she is. The general rule of privilege is 90504(2).
Correct.
And under the general rule, a patient has a privilege to refuse to disclose and to prevent any other person from disclosing confidential communications made or information obtained or disseminated for purposes of diagnosis or treatment. That's the privilege that doesn't exist under 4E2. So if you read the two sections together, how do you get to the conclusion that 4E2 only refers to the opinion?
Well, the 4E2 talks about a reasonable ground for the opinion, and there's no privilege for that. The legislative history indicates that we're worried about the opinion and the disclosure of the opinion.
But just so I can focus this, Section 4 deals with exceptions to the general rule. The general rule involves communications and information.
But 2 says there is no privilege in situations where the examination of an abused or neglected child creates a reasonable ground for an opinion. And in the legislative history, that was the important part. And what I'm suggesting, if I could, is
well, read the end of the sentence. There's no ground, reasonable ground, reasonable ground for an opinion of the physician that the abuse or neglect was other than accidentally caused or inflicted.
Right.
That's a very narrow exception.
And that, again, I've said this, but it relates back to the legislative history, where it was the opinion about the existence of abuse or neglect that was sought to be remedied back in 1963 because doctors felt they could not say a word about a child who came in who was obviously abused or neglected. And the statute required in 1963, after that enactment, that they report that opinion to the local county sheriff or law enforcement agency. And what I'm saying is, if you read the exception under the personal injury, it reads as broadly, if you look at it quickly, it reads as broadly, but in a personal injury case, we don't have a blanket revocation of the physician-patient privilege. Courts go to great lengths to have in-camera inspections of medical records to make sure that it's related to and just about the injuries claimed. And what I'm suggesting here is that if we read this exception broadly, that in the case of an abused child, there's no privilege. So if that child's seen by a doctor, that child's seen by a physician or psychiatrist or psychologist, there's no privilege. I'm suggesting that that opens the floodgates. Once you say there's no privilege, what's to stop a criminal defendant then from saying I have a constitutional right to discover this information because it may benefit my defense? Or the prosecution from saying we want to call in all these treating mental health care providers because it may aid us in our prosecution. And that's the concern. That's why I think we need to read that provision of the statute closely as to the opinion concerning that the abuse or neglect was other than accidentally caused or inflicted by another.
Okay, so the physician says,
that there was, my examination created a reasonable ground for my opinion that she was abused other than accidentally. And then, so next question is, on what basis did you reach that opinion? Right?
Yes.
That's what does the doctor say then?
The doctor says then, at that point we're in a testimonial situation, and that's why I think State v. Speezy needs to be completed. We direct the trial court to say, okay, at this point in time, if that's an issue, we need to know whether or not the victim wants her oral communications with her treating therapist or psychologist or doctor to be privileged. And someone needs to make that call. And I think urge the court to give direction on that to trial courts, because obviously the 5-year-old can't do that. But there may be good reasons why, as in other sexual abuse cases, where the victim wants that to be confidential for other reasons. And then you go into the balancing test under Schiffer for the criminal defendant to protect their rights. But I think we need to instruct and say at that point in time, when there is the opinion expressed, then we have to, even in a criminal case, because we do it in personal injury cases, we do it in family law cases, now in a criminal case, we need to say whether or not this minor child will invoke the privilege for reasons private to that holder of the privilege.
Mr. Dare, you began your argument by putting this case in context, and that was very helpful. You don't represent the defendant.
No.
What? There's a charge of sexual assault against a child that really came to light because of the mother. Why is the mother now, in effect, attempting to frustrate, or that's my impression, frustrate the prosecution of the offender?
And the short answer...
Counsel, would you stand in front of the microphone, please? You're being recorded.
The short answer is I don't know. I know that the trial court had that opportunity to examine the mother and determine if, in fact, the mother was in cahoots, trying to frustrate the process, or if the mother had legitimate reason to try to protect the therapeutic relationship between the therapist and her daughter. And the answer was the trial court found that she was not acting against the best interests of the minor child. Beyond that, I don't know that it's important as far as developing how we're going to treat these matters in the future. I have a concern that icky cases sometimes make laws that are hard to apply universally throughout our jurisprudence. And here is one of those things. We may see a bad motivation by the mother. It may be some other reason. The mother testified in the record that she brought the child and the child's sister to therapy for this and other reasons. And I haven't gone through what those other reasons are. And the court satisfied itself that it was not designed to purposely frustrate or protect her father. She was the one, as you've indicated, initially aided in the reporting of the situation because of her own experiences. So I don't know that we can do that. What we need to do is say, okay, now, and the court in Speezy said, acknowledged the varying interests of family members in family abuse cases and the varying interests of the state in prosecuting these cases, that those interests may not coincide with or be healthy to the interests of the minor child in protecting their physician-patient privilege. So I think the mother's motivation really calls out for why I think we need to address trial courts and say, in these situations, so we don't have to be worried about motivation of a parent, we need to have counsel or a guardian ad litem for the minor child.
Counsel, before you step off, I have one other question. Do you agree that a mother can waive the privilege of confidentiality if she signs a written release?
I think the mother can release medical records. I don't believe that she can waive the testimonial privilege.
Okay, so you're looking at under Chapter 48, really the substantive release of the doctor from the confidentiality requirement, but you don't think that they can be used then in a court proceeding? Is that the line you draw?
No. The line I'm drawing is similar to Steinberg versus Jensen, where the court recognized that you can disclose medical records and not lose the testimonial privilege or the oral communication privilege. I think there's that dichotomy.
Okay. All right. Good. Thank you
very much. I have a question for you. So if you were to draft this opinion, don't spend 50 pages doing it. I want to know what your holding as to the law would be.
First, that the physician-patient privilege resides with the patient only, as you did in Sampson. Two, where there is a minor child involved and the issue of waiving, because I think there's a presumption that we're going to invoke the privilege in all cases. So the issue becomes in waiving the privilege. Then a trial court shall be directed to either appoint a independent counsel or guardian ad litem for the minor child to assist the child in making an objective decision on whether the privilege should be waived in accordance with the best interest standard for the minor child.
Counselor, how can one assist a 3-year-old child in deciding whether she should waive or not waive? Isn't it just going to be some other person other than the mother or father who's going to say yes or no?
We vest that authority in guardian ad litems in divorce cases and in guardian ad litems in personal injury cases. I see this really as no different. We vest that authority in a guardian ad litem in a divorce case in determining where a child should live for the rest of their lives. Certainly.
In a divorce case, the guardian ad litem recommends to the court what the guardian ad litem believes is in the child's best interest, but it is the court that decides where the child will live.
And I'm sorry, I don't mean to suggest that the guardian ad litem would preempt the authority of the court. But I think there needs to be an objective counsel to come to the court and say, look, I think, behalf of my ward or behalf of my client, that the waiver should or should not occur.
So then you would see it as the court directing whether the records are waived as an ultimate factor, based on the recommendation of an independent party?
Yes.
And, okay. you're limiting this to testimonial. We're not dealing with records.
Right.
Dealing with records. I think that's provided for in the other statutes.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Sandra L. Nowak, Assistant Attorney General. I gather this is going to be your last argument,
at least
as projected for this court. Mm. We're sorry to see you go.
May it please the court, I am Assistant Attorney General Sandy Nowak, and I represent the interests of the people of the state of Wisconsin. I'm going to start by answering Justice Abramson's last question, that is, if I were writing this opinion, I would hold two things. First, I would affirm the lower court's determination that in communicating a significant part of the confidential communications volitionally to a third person, Dawn R. waived her minor child's evidentiary privilege. Second, if I were writing this opinion, I would revise this court's holding in State v. Solberg, and I would state that in Shifra Munoz Green situations, the in-camera inspection by a court does not invoke the witness's privilege. I will first address the issue of whether or not Dawn R., as this child's natural guardian, had the authority to waive her child's privilege. And I think the answer is clear that she did. That
Can I stop you for a minute? You're talking about the evidentiary privilege. Are you talking about testimonial privilege? Are you talking about records privilege or both?
Both. I think that's a misleading sort of distinction between the records privilege and the evidentiary privilege, because records are the distinction needs to be made between confidentiality and privileged. Documents are confidential under 5130, but also any discussion of what occurs in those treatment sessions is also confidential under an HSS ruling. So it's not just the documents, it's the clinician's impressions and opinions about what happened there. So the fact that something is reduced in writing doesn't, whether or not it is, doesn't implicate whether or not it's confidential. It is confidential as a matter of law. When we're talking about the evidentiary privilege, and I know the court understands this basic premise, is that we're talking about what can be used in a court of law. And in this state, the rule is that evidentiary rules are applicable in all judicial proceedings. Those evidentiary rules are also applicable when you're trying to determine whether or not an evidentiary privilege exists. The question becomes, is an in-camera inspection for the purposes of determining materiality a judicial proceeding? And there's no case law on point on that specific issue. However, I've directed this court to U.S. v. Zolan in the context of an attorney-client privilege. There's also U.S. v. Nixon in the context of the presidential privilege. And there's another case, which name escapes me, but pertaining to a military privilege, where the federal courts have all said that examining documents for the purposes of determining a privilege through the use of an in-camera inspection does not waive the evidentiary privilege. And that makes sense. When you look at, and I think it's a discussion, the state's interest in protecting citizens from potential sex offenders. I think the case law to this point has done a really good job of balancing that victim's right to privacy and her decision to say, are you going to have my records or not, and the defendant's constitutional right to present a fair case. What the cases have not addressed is the question of the state's interest in public protection. If a victim, such as in this case, where the child's mother, who is a family member, wants to basically obstruct the prosecution, don't the citizens of this state have an interest also in potentially overriding the victim's own privilege at some level to allow the prosecution to proceed? And I think if the court were to amend its holding in Solberg to say that the privilege isn't triggered until after that in-camera inspection, you would be giving credibility to the citizen's right to have a case prosecuted. Because as it stands now, the in-camera inspection is triggered at the point of a showing of materiality. We don't know at that point whether or not those records contain the sought-after information. At this point, the way the law now stands, if a victim says, I'm not going to waive my evidentiary privilege, the case stops. And what we know is that those records may not, in the end, actually implicate the defendant's constitutional right to present evidence. And so the citizens of the state lose their ability to prosecute a potentially dangerous person without the defendant's individual rights ever having been implicated.
But counsel, aren't the victim's rights to the confidentiality of the records implicated when a judge's eyes read the record? And that's what an in-camera communication or inspection is all about. So they're no longer confidential between the caregiver and the patient at that point.
That is true, Your Honor, but I think that these are the kinds of sticky issues that we're going to have to struggle with here. Yes, there will be that limited sort of entry into that therapy relationship. However, certainly those relationships are no more important than the presidential privilege or military secrets. It's a balancing test that is a question for this court to decide, and I think we can trust generally our circuit court judges to maintain the confidence of that information for the purpose of the in-camera inspection only. The other thing I'd like to point out, and that I think counsel has been missing, is that once an evidentiary privilege is waived, and I don't think that the law currently recognizes this either, you can't partially waive an evidentiary privilege. That's clear from the Federal Advisory Committee notes to proposed Federal Rule 511, which was adopted in Wisconsin by Section 90511. Once confidentiality is destroyed through voluntary disclosure, no subsequent claim of privilege can restore it, and knowledge and lack of knowledge of the existence of the privilege appears to be irrelevant. So what you've done to this point with our procedure in these kind of cases, is allowed a partial waiver of privilege for the purpose of the in-camera inspection. In reality, there's no such thing as a partial waiver. It is absolute. Once the cat is let out of the bag, it doesn't come out. And what my concern is on behalf of victims is, at this point, we're making that victim decide to waive her privilege at the point of the in-camera inspection. She can't ever get it back. If there's another criminal proceeding, that privilege has been waived.
Well, you know, in this particular case, I have some concerns because we're talking about conduct. And you first have to interpret the conduct as being a waiver. And secondly, you have to determine whether it's fair in these circumstances to conclude that it was a waiver of the privilege. What concerns me in this particular case is, what if the mom made all this up? What if she just made it up that she heard the daughter say nothing happened in the counseling session? How can you waive someone's privilege by something you made up? We don't even know if this is true or not.
And that, I think, gets us to the point of whether or not a guardian ad litem should have been appointed. And I think, unfortunately, we're well past that in the procedure of this case. When the circuit court made the determination that the mother was acting in her child's interest, that, I think, is the end of the story for us here today, that we have to start with the assumption that the mother is going to be acting in her child's best interest until there is concrete, specific evidence to the contrary. And that's not the issue that we have before the court today. So I think if you're starting with the idea that the mother was acting in her child's best interest, or was acting in her child's interest, perhaps not the best interest, but acting in her child's interest when she waived the privilege, she waived it. Whether she regrets it today or not is irrelevant. And that makes sense when we, again, getting back to one of the issues that I think the petition was granted in terms of whether there needs to be a specific intent to waive the evidentiary privilege. Remember that there's this rule of strict construction for rules of privilege, that our justice system gives great value to getting as much information before a fact finder as we can, that privileges are seen as derogations of the search for truth. And so if you start with that idea and then look at what the privilege is really intended to do, it's intended to put the person who's benefiting from treatment in a position of controlling who other than those two people knows about this information. Once that person makes a decision to disclose it to one other person, they've taken that information out of that sort of sacred relationship.
But isn't that part of the problem, Ms. Nowak? The person who is arguably, assuming there is a privilege, the person who has arguably waived the privilege in this case is not the patient. It's the patient's mother, who is also related to the offender. So you've got this relationship here where the person who has brought this to light is the mother of the child, the daughter of the offender. This is all interrelated, but it's the child's privilege we're talking about, not the mother's privilege, right?
Yes.
Doesn't that cause some problems in the context of this particular case? How do you have a knowing waiver of privilege by the child here? You don't. You have a waiver, arguably, assuming there is a privilege, by mom, who may have other interests involved. It's just wrong, as I suggest.
And intuitively, I'd have to agree with you. If I were trying this case in the lower court, I might have handled that hearing on whether or not a GAO should be appointed differently. But under the facts of this case, as we have them, we have to start with the proposition that mother is standing in the shoes of her child. And that power and authority is conferred by statute. To suggest that the statute doesn't allow anyone to waive the privilege because it doesn't use the word parent or specifically saying natural guardian is contrary to that.
What statute are you talking about?
I'm talking about 90504.
And where does it talk about waiver? If I can just interrupt the flow for a minute.
And that was 90511.
90511?
Mm-hmm. And specifically 90504 sub 3, who may claim the privilege?
But we're talking about waiving it, and waiving it is different than claiming it. We have a totally separate statute on waiving it, 90511, and it speaks to the person on whom this chapter confers a privilege. Where is the mom conferred the privilege?
Under 90504 sub 3, when it talks about the guardian, the fact that the term guardian has to be construed. This becomes then a simple issue of statutory construction.
But that's claiming the privilege. And you're asking us to conclude that claiming the privilege under sub 3 of 90504 is equated with someone on whom the statutes have conferred the privilege. And you say that it was conferred by 03, and therefore 90511 says that the parent stands in the shoes as one who has been conferred with the privilege.
That is correct, and I think then you also combine that with 5130. I'm not recalling the subsection, which says that the parents have the authority to waive confidentiality on behalf of their child. The child itself has the authority at age 14 and over. But specifically, the Chapter 51 gives the parents the authority to waive confidentiality.
But it's also subject to Chapter 905.
Right.
90405. So you're still going to come back to these same statutes anyway.
Well, they are all interlinked because if mom, in this case, where she did actually sign the authorization for release, I think that you could find that she waived the privilege when she signed that release.
Mm-hmm. Also, can you walk down that path, though? Because if you really want to link this to 5130, 5130 requires informed consent, not consent by conduct.
But if you have a valid waiver of the confidentiality under 5130, you have that, I think, is a different issue about what's required to waive confidentiality versus the evidentiary privilege. Because and that specifically actually supports the state's position, because in Chapter 51, they talk about the requirement for informed consent, and that is not required under privilege. Under privilege, it says voluntary disclosure. So it talks only of voluntariness, not being informed about the legal nature of the act itself. And it makes sense, again, from my brief, if I can quote myself, under...
With authority.
Thank you. Under the proposed theory, the mother could put information on a billboard and say, well, I didn't know that there was an evidentiary privilege, and there's nothing served in terms of keeping that, in promoting that confidential relationship by that sort of rule of law. And again, remembering that we have such a heavy push toward making information available to the finder of fact.
No, Counselor, aren't your arguments going to be of great help to defense counsel if you prevail? Because if we write an opinion that says, when a mom talks about something that happens in a therapy session, the privilege is gone, and the mom may tell the prosecuting attorney about it in preparation for trial, well, then you've told a third party, how come now the defendant can't have everything? It's been waived.
They probably could. And I think what you're talking about, I mean, you're going to have to get to a showing of materiality, first of all, but if it implicates the defendant's constitutional right to a fair trial, and if the prosecutor has information such as this where a child has recanted in a therapy session, the state has an obligation, and I think courts would be hard-pressed not to hold what the defendant had with.
I'm concerned about the ramifications. It's one thing in a case like this when we're talking about a 5-year-old, 4-year-old, 3-year-old. But what about a 16-year-old? And I'm the parent of a 16-year-old, and we're in therapy. And then I go tell Grandma about the therapy session. Am I waiving, Vanna's mother, the privilege, the physician, patient privilege of my 16-year-old daughter or son?
I think there's a legal issue there that's going to have to be decided it's my position that when the child has the authority to waive or authorize access to her records or revoke it, the parents also have sort of a contemporaneous role. But I think the difference in what you're talking about with a 16-year-old involved in family therapy, the 16-year-old can prohibit the mother from disclosing the information or waiving the privilege because they are both being treated within that session. I think that if And in that case, I think you could make a determination, or the court could, that the mother was not acting in her child's interests. And if the child was competent, I think the court could make a conclusion that the child alone held the privilege. But I think that those are the sort of sticky issues that we can't get past. And I don't think looking at the rule of law of in-camera inspections and whether or not the privilege is implicated, I don't think that changes that. I think the law would be the very same today. And the truth of the matter is, I think prosecutors have been nobody wants to prosecute a case where we're forcing this sexual assault victim to produce her records, therapy records. That's a nightmare situation. Normally, I mean, you want the victim to make that decision personally. I think very often, by the time a defendant can make a materiality showing, I'm frankly surprised that this is the first claim of waiver of privilege that we're seeing, because that materiality showing requires that they know pretty much about what was going on in the therapy session. And so victims may be waiving their privilege as it is. If I tell my boyfriend what went on in my therapy session, my privilege has been waived. So I don't think this rule of law changes it. I think it's an unfortunate situation, but I don't think the proposed rule of law will change that.
There's no please point me in the right direction, but aren't most in-camera inspections inspections of records or documents as opposed to actual obtaining testimony of witnesses?
Most. I have had a situation in a circuit court where a judge interviewed a child in camera.
Are you aware of any published decisions that deal with in-camera testimony?
No.
Thank you.
This case is complicated by SAMHSA, which the Court of Appeals relied on, but it was their own opinion which was overturned by this court. Because in Samson, the court said, as to the attorney-client privilege, not this privilege, a claimant does not necessarily have authority to waive. So the attorney can claim it but can't waive it. And here you have the same kind of issue. And it's also complicated by the fact that, as I understand this, this was family counseling.
I disagree respectfully.
Okay, well, that's why I'm raising this. So if you think it was just for the children, the two children involved, was the mother present?
As best I can tell, that's what I think. That's one of the problems with this being like the third permutation of what Dawn R.'s position is that the record really doesn't develop it. But I think if you read the affidavit itself, talks about mom observing play therapy. And as a former social worker, I don't know of any situation in which she'd be doing play therapy as part of a family therapy session.
It's not for an adult play therapy.
Right. Okay. And again, I think if mom were actually part of that treatment group and they had brought that out when the court was trying to decide about the guardian ad litem, we might have had a guardian ad litem appointed for that reason, because mom then has her own interest in her treatment. But I don't think that's what the record bears out.
So for the state's purposes, this would have to be viewed as just therapy of the children, which was observed by the mother, and that she therefore was not involved in having her own privilege.
That's correct. And even that, I think the record shows that the record was not clear about how much of the sessions mom actually watched or heard. If there are no further questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Noah. Mr. Darrow, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
My whole career as a lawyer has dreamed of the day I'd be in front of the court arguing a case. It's very much of an honor to me. My dream included that I'd be at the case from day one. I would have crafted the pleadings. I would have been there in the trial court. I would have been there in the court of appeals. And this case came to me on the petition for review. So I'm kind of stuck with a lot of stuff that has happened down below, just as the state is. But I don't think, and I thought that was a disadvantage until I started thinking about this more and more, preparing for argument. I do divorce work, and I do personal injury work. And I've read comments on the Loeb and Herman website about the Court of Appeals decision. I've seen how this will affect other areas of practice. And I don't think that Sampson is something we need to shy or should shy away from in this case, because Sampson made very clear, perhaps finally, very clear some basic principles. And that is, even though a person may by statute be able to raise or claim the privilege, as in the attorney case, they cannot waive it. That privilege belongs to the client or the patient. And I think that needs to be reaffirmed because, you know, the SH case, the State versus SH, is something similar. If we get into nuances like they did in the Court of Appeals, whether it was a substantial disclosure or an insignificant disclosure, I don't think that helps us in all the areas of the law that are practiced in the state beyond a criminal case. If we're going to argue over whether a disclosure by someone other than the patient was substantial or insignificant, we're going to carry this debate on and on and on forevermore.
Counselor, you know, the records of these sessions have been provided to both sides, correct?
I'm sorry, Judge?
The records of the counseling sessions were provided to both sides, correct?
I have to say, I don't know that they were provided to the criminal defendant in this case. I don't know that. My understanding, there was an in-camera inspection by the trial court judge who found nothing inculpatory or exculpatory, and that's where they reside.
Okay. So the defendant then has never seen them, just the trial judge. But I understood that the district attorney had them. Is that incorrect?
That's incorrect. I believe counsel is shaking her head too. We're both kind of on this at the end. But I believe that's correct. Only the trial court, which goes to whether or not privilege was ever waived because they were ordered to be produced. Okay. KLR never said, okay, here, Judge, you can look at my records. She never consented to the release of those records. But I'm sorry.
Okay. Now, that was my question. I'm just trying to get it straightened out because I've read different things in the record and the Court of Appeals opinion is on a different track. So...
And I think the landscape was different when we were at the Court of Appeals because of Sampson, Court of Appeals Sampson, where they did talk about whether it was substantial or insignificant. And I think the bottom line has got to be on these privileges, whether it's attorney-client, physician-patient, or communications to a clergy member, that the privilege resides in the person who is in that confidential relationship and only that person. If we hold something else, we're going to have forevermore in the clergy relationship, for instance, if a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old daughter is going to her pastor for counseling about how she's going to get along with her mother. In a divorce case, if mom mentions to dad one night or to grandma one night, gee, little Jeannie said to the pastor she really doesn't like I wear plaid and she wears stripes, are we then going to say the privilege has been revoked such that dad can then, in a divorce case, make the pastor testify as to all the conversations that went on between the child and the pastor in determining placement? And I think we have to look at it beyond the criminal case. We have to look at it in making a rule that will apply to all types of lawsuits or cases that are brought before the court. And that is of ultimate importance, I think.
Well, Mr. Darrow, but I want to bring you back to the criminal setting.
Okay.
And I'm concerned about the rule that we're evolving here. Isn't it in the public's best interest? Many child abuse situations, child neglect situations, necessarily involve parents. Is that correct? I mean, or other family members, right?
Sure, that's a high percentage, I would guess.
So when you're looking at a rule, and I'm looking once again at 4E2, isn't it in the public's best interest to protect children against abuse and neglect to say that there really isn't a privilege if the doctor has an opinion that that child has been abused or neglected?
Justice Butler, what I'm suggesting is the other side of the coin. Yes, the state can stand up here and very impassionately say, we need to protect minor children, we need to prosecute offenders. And I don't disagree with that.
Not just prosecuting offenders. I'm less concerned about that and more concerned about protecting children victims.
And that's my concern. And I suggest there's the other side to that, which is there may be occasions where protecting the child means we keep inviolate the physician-patient communication and privilege to protect that child in the long run. And that's an interest different than the state has. It's an interest different than the criminal defendant has. And I'm suggesting that if we read that exception to say there is no privilege, we have to look forward and say, well, what will that mean on a day-to-day basis in a trial court? If there's no privilege, what's to stop a criminal defendant from demanding and getting all of those records and communications between the victim and their doctor? And that, I suggest, needs balancing. And that is why the statute is needs to be looked at strictly and carefully.
Chief, if I may ask a question, aren't you confusing records with testimonial privilege in your last response? You know, what's to keep a defendant from getting all of those? I assume you're referring to records.
Well, records, yes, records and testimony, though. And this case involves the testimonial privilege. But if we think about it, if there's no privilege, we go back to the Mental Health Act, and then the criminal defendant's not one of the enumerated people who can disclose medical records. But if we look at the relationship between a doctor and a patient, if there's no privilege, then I have access to it. I mean,
if that necessarily follows. You're assuming that it necessarily follows. I don't know that it necessarily follows that if there's a determination that there's no evidentiary privilege, that automatically means records that are confidential under the statute must be disclosed.
Well, under 5130, though, sub 6, it says that this section superseded by 90504. So if we interpret 90504 to say there's no privilege, then doesn't that supersede the protections in 5130?
Well, you can argue on materiality that the record should not be shown, even though it's not privileged, it's sensitive, and that unless there can be proof that it's relevant and material, you don't release it.
But to do that, we have to discover.
Yes, but as you have pointed out at least twice in this case, there was a turnover of these records to the court without either party seeing them, as best we can tell.
Sure.
So the discovery there was by the court, not by either party.
That's also true. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Darrow, and thank you, Ms. Nowak. And we're, as I say, sorry to see you leave, and thank you for excellent arguments and a twist on privilege and confidentiality. That concludes our hearing in 03-0384CR, State versus Dennis L.R. And Justice Bradley will meet with the students, and we are on recess until 1:30.